Welcome to the podcast of the City Club of Eugene, Oregon. The City Club builds community vision through open inquiry and is dedicated to enabling an informed public on a wide range of topics. Coming up in today's program.
Whether consolidation of hospitals and other healthcare systems is going to preserve access to high-quality care, or whether such consolidations might lead to higher prices and decreased access is one of the big questions today.
We appreciate the sponsors who make our civic work possible, including Kaiser Permanente, kp.org, Lane Community College, lanecc.edu, Peace Health, peacehealth.org, the University of Oregon, uoregon.edu, and generous support from Lane County and the City of Eugene. And here's today's program.
Welcome to the City Club of Eugene's July 22, 2022 program, Mergers and Medicine, How Consolidation in Healthcare Affects Oregonians. My name is Karin Knutson and I am City Club's president. In today's program, Mergers and Medicine, How Consolidation in Healthcare Affects Oregonians, and a special thank you to Sandra Bishop and Andrew Kolak for coordinating today's program. Thank you.
Thank you, Karin. Good afternoon. It's my honor today to introduce our speakers for this very important program, Mergers and Medicine, How Consolidation in Healthcare Affects Oregonians. Whether consolidation of hospitals and other healthcare systems is going to preserve access to high-quality care, or whether such consolidations might lead to higher prices and decreased access is one of the big questions today. In 2021, the Oregon legislature enacted House Bill 2362, increasing oversight of healthcare-related mergers, acquisitions, and some affiliations in the state. Under this law, the Oregon Health Authority is required to review certain high-value mergers, acquisitions, and as I said, even certain types of affiliations that might affect quality, access, and the price of healthcare. Today, we have three speakers. Zachary Goldman is the healthcare cost economist for the Oregon Health Authority. He works with the Healthcare Market Oversight Program. That was the program set up by that recently passed legislation. His previous work included a position in California where he helped launch the Covered California program during implementation of the Affordable Care Act. Craig Delena is an assistant professor in the Operations and Business Analytics Department at the University of Oregon Lundquist College of Business. His background includes work at Duke University Health System and Guy's and St. Thomas's National Health Service Foundation Trust in London, England. Is our third speaker, Gary Bruce, is a healthcare attorney in the Bend, Oregon office of Schwabe, Williamson, and Wyatt. Gary has extensive experience with regulatory and governance matters related to healthcare, including mergers and acquisitions. He provides counsel to health systems, hospitals, and other types of healthcare providers. Prior to entering private practice, he served as vice president and general counsel for the St. Charles Health System in Central Oregon. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to our first speaker, Craig Delena.
Thank you very much for having me, and thanks everyone for being here. I mean, it's a privilege for me to participate in this discussion, so thank you very much. I'd like to start by trying to provide a little bit of background to give us some context for our discussion. So the health system in the US, as we know, costs us a lot more than it costs people in other countries. However, we don't necessarily have better quality than other countries. And I think one of the most fundamental reasons for this is that the US healthcare system is in fact a series or a patchwork of different structures that weren't necessarily designed in order to ensure people have access to high quality healthcare at reasonable prices. To give you some examples of what I mean, the reason people under 65 primarily have employer-based health insurance, was actually part of a plan from the government to fight inflation during World War II. It's not because they thought that was the best way to finance healthcare, because we had another problem and this was a way to deal with it. Another example, if you've ever been to the hospital, you might have gotten a separate bill from the hospital and a separate bill from the physicians. Well, the reason for this is actually because, I mean, before 1900s or so, hospitals and physicians were separate entities. And despite the fact that we've had, I mean, much closer relationships between hospitals and physicians, the, I mean, management of their services and the payment for those services have remained separate. So, I mean, what I want to try and get across here is that we've had a lack of planning in the U.S. healthcare system, and this has resulted in a fragmented structure with overly complicated interworkings to try and make all these pieces fit together. Now, provider consolidation offers one way that, I mean, in theory, we can address this, and it could help to improve outcomes and quality and lower costs, right? And this consolidation happens in multiple ways, but the three big ways are when physicians consolidate with each other. So this is one small physician practice becoming a very large physician practice. Hospitals can also consolidate with other hospitals. So this is hospitals becoming health systems. And these two types of consolidation are typically referred to as horizontal consolidation within either hospitals or physicians because they're within the same types of providers. There's also what's called vertical consolidation. It's not necessarily a perfect naming for this, but it's because physicians and hospitals, when they consolidate together, right, there's some vertical structure between the two. They're not sort of parallel or side by side. So these are the three types of consolidation, and they've been increasing over the past 15 to 20 years to varying rates. Now, the research has tried to really understand what are the effects of this consolidation, and ultimately, is it beneficial? Does it benefit patients? Now, I don't want to try and walk you through all of the individual research papers, but if I might share a quote from a recent research paper by Drs. Hannah Naprash and Michael McWilliams that appeared in an article of the Antitrust Law Journal in 2019. They reviewed all the literature on these three types of integration, and their, I mean, ultimate conclusion was consolidation amongst healthcare providers, whether horizontal or vertical, doesn't on average result in welfare enhancing efficiencies. This is a bit of a mouthful, but in English, what this means is that provider consolidation doesn't generally or necessarily benefit patients. However, I want to make clear that it doesn't say there can't be benefits. Right? And I mean, the evidence behind this conclusion is really based on the fact that certain types of these consolidations actually are associated with increased costs, increased prices, but without necessarily a benefit to quality that's been sort of consistently documented. Give you a little bit of, I mean, insight into why this is and what's going on. If we look at hospital consolidation, the research here shows very mixed results. So a lot of times there's no impact on costs and quality to patients. Right, so when I'm talking about costs, I don't mean necessarily hospital costs. It may help hospitals better manage their costs, but I'm talking about costs to sort of society or patients. But we're not seeing consistent benefits to reductions in spending or costs or quality when hospitals consolidate. However, when physicians consolidate with other physicians, there are consistent associations with increased price. And the most common reason for this is these larger physician practices are actually able to negotiate higher prices with insurers. So it doesn't necessarily change anything about the services provided, but they're reimbursed at higher prices. Again, in this case, we're not seeing a lot of strong evidence one way or the other that physician consolidation helps or harms quality. So we're seeing an increase in spending, no benefits into quality. Additionally, in terms of the literature on vertical integration, this is also associated with increased prices, right? Partially because of increase in negotiated prices. Other times they can exploit differences in payment structures. So hospital outpatients departments, same services if delivered in these departments will actually be paid at a much higher rate than if they were delivered in a physician's outpatient office, right? That's not tied to a hospital. And this can also lead to increased prices in terms of vertical integration. And again, no consistent evidence of a benefit to quality. Some literature does indeed document some small benefits. Others or most document no benefits to quality. And some actually show a degradation of quality, maybe driven by reduced competition between providers. Just some quick caveats to what the research knows. These things are admittedly very hard to study. We can't randomize this. We can't do experiments, and that makes them difficult. What this means is that we're comparing averages from data we observe. We're not doing sort of a gold standard clinical controlled trial. What we have to try and understand is when we're comparing averages, what does this mean on an individual basis? Well, unfortunately, not always very much. We need to consider on a case-by-case basis what are the benefits versus the costs associated with consolidation. Right? So despite the fact that we have some average associations that should tell us we need to be cautious, doesn't mean we shouldn't say no integration. Right? Additionally, payment models are changing. A lot of this research is focused on integration under fee-for-service, where providers are all paid by the volume of services they provide. We're starting to change that. We're seeing bundled payments, alternative care organizations, and we don't yet know how provider integration is really going to play a role under these alternative reimbursement structures. So, I mean, in summary, we have lots of different providers working in an overly complicated system to try and help people. It's very difficult. Consolidation, in theory, offers a way to approach this, but the research shows that, I mean, the benefits don't necessarily transfer to patients or society. So there's reason to be skeptical, particularly around physician integration with hospitals, as to whether or not these need to be regulated more tightly than they might be in other settings. So with that, I'd like to thank you all very much for the opportunity to come in and speak. And I believe next is Zachary Goldman.
Thanks for inviting me. This is a real honor. I want to talk a little bit about how we got where we are today. Talk a little bit about the legislative history and then the intentions of the program. And I'll end with some of the program parameters and some of the design, which I think you'll find interesting. So as Sandra said, last year, the Oregon legislature passed and the governor signed a new law, and it established a brand new program called the Healthcare Market Oversight Program. It sits within the Oregon Health Authority. And there are two objectives that I want to talk about of the program. One is simply to create more transparency when healthcare entities like clinics, hospitals, or even health insurance companies are planning a transaction like a merger or an acquisition, a joint partnership, or others. This level of transparency is particularly important because there are cases in other states in which after an acquisition, there's instances in which an emergency department closes. Or a given clinic stops providing a particular kind of healthcare services. And the transparency provides the community an opportunity to weigh in and share thoughts about what a proposed transaction may do for them, how it may help them, or how it may harm them as those entities kind of describe what that proposed transaction is and would do. So that's the first objective, just increase transparency. Plain and simple. The second, and Sandra mentioned this at the top, requires OHA to analyze transactions and determine any negative impacts on consumers regarding health costs, as we just heard about, healthcare quality, access to healthcare, and lastly, health equity, which is a really important piece. So functionally, the Oregon Health Authority will review a given transaction and assess how that transaction would impact any of these four domains, cost, quality, access, health equity. So those are the two primary objectives. It's important to note that before launching this program last March, the brand new program, the Oregon Health Authority spent months and months working very closely with consumer advocates and consumer advocacy organizations, as well as healthcare industry representatives, so that this program could strike a balance between achieving these objectives that I just mentioned and, to the extent possible, minimizing the administrative burden on the healthcare system. For example, let's say two clinics want to establish a joint partnership between the two, and they want to share an electronic health record system. So they'll share a license, they'll coordinate. If they're signing a contract so that they can share resources. Such a transaction, a joint partnership, is not reviewable, right? That's an administrative function. It sounds like they're going to get a good deal on the electronic health record system. go for it. No review required, no notification required. Another example, let's say two or even three hospitals want to create a formal business agreement in which they can buy supplies in bulk and get a better deal. Again, not reviewable, right? So there's a lot of these kind of administrative transactions that occur all the time, every day, in the healthcare system and in Oregon, for which no notification is required, right? The program is not subjecting those kinds of transactions to review. But if it is a merger or an acquisition or a corporate affiliation, then it would be reviewable only if the size of the entities are sufficiently large enough. So if one entity has revenue of $10 million and another entity has revenue of $12 million per year. So the really small health entities are completely exempted. It's really these kind of medium and larger sized entities that are subject to review. There's also a component of the program that we developed that if there's an emergency situation, let's say, for example, a clinic is in financial trouble and another company is willing to come in and buy them, acquire them, and kind of prop them up financially in order to keep the doors open and to allow that clinic to continue seeing patients for the community, that would be exempt from the program, right? So there's a number of kind of important caveats to this review process that ensures the administrative burden is kind of mitigated to the extent possible, but at the same time, trying to achieve the goals of greater transparency, as well as the review of a given transaction on the impact to consumers in the domains of cost, quality, access, and health equity. Today, the program is up and running. In fact, just last week, we reported our first transaction review, and that's posted on our website. We approved a transaction. It was an acquisition. Let me just end with kind of an overall process on how this works functionally. So when a healthcare entity is contemplating a transaction, at the point at which they're kind of ready to move forward to submit the transaction for review, they submit a notice and they send the notice. It's a three-page form to the health authority. We post that notice. So again, there's that transparency piece. And then we conduct what's called a preliminary review. That's a 30-day review. And this was, again, another example of how this tries to strike a balance. 30 days is a relatively short time period, particularly given how long these transactions typically take to negotiate and work all the details out. So for a 30-day period, we subject it to review. The Oregon Health Authority can review it, approve it or approve it with conditions. And if that's the case, it kind of stops there and the transaction can move forward. However, if there are significant concerns during the preliminary review, the Oregon Health Authority has the ability to do a more thorough review, a comprehensive review, which can last longer. And then afterwards makes a decision at that point. So, you know, trying to not prolong any timelines unnecessarily, we have this narrower 30-day review after which we can make a decision. But if there are potential significant cost impacts to consumers, quality concerns, concerns about access, maybe one entity is going to close as a result of a transaction or reduce its number of services provided, or on a health equity front, there are some problems that arise from that preliminary review, then we can extend that timeline. So that's just a little bit of the legislative history, what the intentions were at the kind of while the bill was moving through the legislature, a little bit about the program mechanics and where we are today. So happy to talk more about it. And I think from here, I'll pass along to the next panelist.
Thank you, Zachary. And thanks for including me in this discussion today. I've been getting chemo treatments recently that have caused me to lose my hair, but also caused me to be very interested in this issue of healthcare access. And it relates directly to our talk today. So I want to start out and put you in the seat of a small hospital leadership team. So we have 33 rural hospitals in Oregon. And I'm going to back up just a little bit to say there are 600 rural hospitals in the United States. 30% of those hospitals, according to a recent government report, are at risk of failing or collapsing in the near future. In Oregon, we have four hospitals that have been designated as being at high risk of closing. Two of those are at extreme risk of closing. Those are Southern Coos Hospital and Health Center in Bandon and Lower Umpqua Hospital District in Reedsport. Both of those hospitals are hospitals whose operating margins are negative and who have been able to remain afloat because their investment returns or other sources of income have allowed them to meet their bottom lines. But those of you who are looking at your retirement plans may know that the market is not killing it this year. So these hospitals that traditionally have relied upon their investment portfolios to float their bottom lines are looking at 2022 and saying, we could be in trouble. So you are the leadership team of one of these small rural hospitals. And your goal is to serve your local community, to provide a full coterie of services, to provide affordable care, and to treat those populations, which, by the way, are dwindling because our demographics in the United States, people are moving from rural areas to urban. But that aside, you have to say, you're looking at your hospital, and in many of these cases, people are looking at their hospitals and saying, gosh, this hospital has been here for 50 years. It needs a lot of work, but we don't have money to do repairs. And, you know, today's health systems really need a good electronic medical record system. And electronic medical record systems are not cheap. We need that, but we don't have money for that. So what are we going to do? We could try to raise our prices, but, you know, there's only so much blood you can squeeze out of the rock. And at some point, we got to look at our finances and say, this just isn't working. And so many hospitals across the United States are facing this dilemma. So what do? You've got a couple options. You can close up shop, or perhaps you can find a partner. And maybe if you can find a health system that has some money, maybe you can get the capital infusion, the IT support, the other resources that you need to stay afloat. The problem is, if the regulatory burden to make that transaction is too high, you become a very unattractive target when you put the for sale sign in your front yard. So I think it would be very difficult to come here today and say, I'm against transparency. I'm against lower costs. But when we're looking at consolidation and merger issues, we have to think about what the alternative is. In many of these communities, the alternative to consolidation is collapse. The health systems now are looking, both small hospitals and larger systems are looking at transactions and asking themselves, is it worth it? Under the new healthcare merger bill, a health system that, or two parties that are interested in a transaction, have to give 180-day notice of the transaction. That, as Zachary explained better than I can, that transaction notice will go to the government. The government will do an assessment. And, I should mention, there's an application fee for the parties. And the costs of the process are borne by the parties. So all of these these costs, these time delays create disincentives to the parties to move forward with a merger and make that small rural hospital a less attractive target for the health system. So I think it is, while transparency, of course, is an admirable goal, increasing quality, increasing equity, those are all goals for which we should strive as a healthcare system. The question, I think, is whether this new merger bill will take us closer to that, to achievement of that goal, or farther away. Thank you.
If you enjoyed this presentation by the City Club of Eugene, please visit our website at cityclubofeugene.org or our YouTube channel and our social media pages.